Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to all our listeners. This is the Business Day Spotlight, your destination for African business made simple. And for today, we are talking about something that is affecting all of our lives increasingly, and that is the issue of digital security. Some people call it cyber security, and there are a lot of companies that are dedicated to this particular cause, because as more and more of our lives are going digital and have gone digital, the risks are mounting even more, especially as people try to either, you know, steal from us online, or to simply just make sure that, you know, if maybe it's a Nigerian prince, or maybe you have an inheritance from somewhere around the world, just minimizing all of those issues. So we're going to be talking to Neil Hare Brown, who is the CEO of Storm Guidance, just to hear about a new product that they have. And I say product, but it's more like a service, and I'm very interested in it, because now the way that I sort of conceptualize it in my head is that if you are in your house, usually in certain suburbs, if something happens, you call a rapid response team that usually has, you know, security and all that. But if your business, if you're a small business owner and you're attacked digitally, you know, what do you do? And just from at least my understanding, cyber care sounds like it is sort of like, you know, that type of a response unit if you find yourself having been attacked. So Neil, greetings to you today.
Thanks very much, Maduwa. Thank you very much for having me.
I think a good place for us to start, you know, is maybe getting a sense for those that may not have heard of Storm Guidance or CyberCare, just understanding the company itself. So maybe in brief, just understanding, you know, Storm Guidance and your interest when it comes to, you know, issues of cybersecurity.
Absolutely, yeah. Thank you very much. So we were formed in early 2014, in the UK, and we've got offices in the UK, in Mauritius, in the US, and we're just starting now in South Africa as well, and also in India. So we've been growing pretty much in line with the growth in cybercrime, and we essentially provide three services: assessments. We assess cyber risk for businesses, give them an idea of where their main exposures are and what to do about them. We provide a planning service to help them build incident response plans for how to respond to incidents when they occur, and how to do that really effectively and minimize the losses. And then we also have a response team, which provides the digital investigations and the recovery services to prevent organizations suffering too badly when incidents actually occur.
And when it comes to, you know, your assessment, just because you're in Mauritius right now, like you said, sort of having started out in the UK, what do you make of cybersecurity on the continent, right? You said that you guys are starting starting out in South Africa now, you're in Mauritius. What do you make of cybersecurity, you know, on the continent? Are we taking it seriously enough?
I think it's not too bad, I would say, on the continent. There are certain real advantages in the big growth of South African business, and also many other African countries, because in a way you don't have the same these businesses don't have the same legacy of old technology, but nonetheless it's still very important to keep technologies up to date. Obviously, that means an investment and it means expense in doing that. So to do that smartly, to be very careful about how systems are configured, that's important. But I would say generally, Africa's in a pretty good place. And certainly it's in a good place now to go forward in a much more secure future, as long as organizations, I think, consider the various strategies that they need to keep themselves secure. And don't think of it as just an IT problem. Cyber risk and cyber crime is very much a blended attack problem, a blended issue. And it involves just as much the scamming or the manipulation of individuals and people and social engineering, what we call social engineering, as it does taking advantage of technical vulnerabilities. So it's very important to have this type of viewpoint to make sure that boardrooms and companies of all sizes consider. There are seven key strategies that I won't have time to go over that today, but certainly if any organization wants to learn about seven key strategies to keep their businesses secure, then they can go to cyber7.global website. And those basically give them a really good idea about the level of investment that they're going to need, the staffing that they're going to need, those types of things, the technologies that they need to keep updated, just to keep on top of the risk and to address it, to have a very good level of confidence that they're not too exposed.
When it comes to, the risks, for you guys to then come up with something like CyberCare, right? Am I understanding it correctly? Because I did describe it earlier on as sort of, the digital version of the rapid response systems that we tend to have in neighborhoods. If there's a break-in at a business or at a house, etc., that's the analogy I'm using. Are we understanding that correctly?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. It's a hotline for rapid response for small businesses when they have a cyber incident. And the first thing we do is we'll triage. If they call the hotline, we'll triage the situation just to make sure, confirm that they are actually suffering a cyber incident, a cyber attack. It may be that they could have some other issue. But certainly once we've confirmed it's an incident, then we'll spring into action. We'll assign digital forensics experts. We'll do lots and lots of other things, everything really from investigating how the issue has occurred, what we call the first or the initial point of compromise, making sure that systems are no longer vulnerable and that we've blocked the attackers out, and all the way through to recovering systems and getting the business back up and running. And that includes the more specialist services such as ransomware negotiation, such as trauma counselling, pretty much everything you can think of that's needed, we can provide under the CyberCare service. So you've hit the nail on the head, really. It is a rapid response service for cybercrime.
One of the things I'm very interested in that you've just mentioned is ransomware negotiations. Am I then correct in understanding that we've sort of reached that stage as a society where... when a ransomware attack comes in, right, that people and businesses are sort of negotiating with people that are holding their data or their information, ransom? Because, there's always been that famous line, we always hear it in the movies, the United States talking about, we don't negotiate with the terrorists and, all of that. But when it comes to cyber criminals, I guess the question is, is negotiation the way forward, or has that just become the standard practice?
Well, it's an absolutely great question. So I would say, we deal with hundreds of incidents a year, and I would say that it's only a very low single figure percentage that we actually get involved with paying the ransom. We've got a number of techniques now which can enable organizations to recover their data without having to pay the ransom. There is a new element that attackers have brought in the last 18 months, 2 years, where they actually steal data and then use that as another lever. The fact that they're going to release that data to the press, to the public, to the victim's customers, to even ambulance chasing law firms, to try and use that as more leverage to get them to pay the ransom, as well as obviously being able to decrypt the data. But what we try and do is to be really proactive. As I said, we've dealt with hundreds and hundreds of these incidents now, and we've got lots of different techniques that we can use to try and get the data back without having to pay the ransom. In the very small percentage of cases where that's necessary, what we do is we'll negotiate. We can usually find, to be honest, it's sometimes worth negotiating even if you've got no intention of paying the ransom. There's a couple of reasons for that. One is that you can delay the attackers to give you enough time to make notifications to those that might be affected and the regulators. The Poppy Act is a good example of a law in South Africa where it requires, for instance, that those who are suffering data breaches, perform some investigative analysis in order to understand whether or not data subjects are at high risk, and then to notify them of that. So that takes time, as I'm sure you'll appreciate, and sometimes it's worthwhile negotiating or setting up sometimes a bit of a fake negotiation in order to extend the length of time before the attackers release any breach data. The other thing is that attackers usually offer samples of the data that they've stolen as, you know, what we call a sort of digital proof of life. And so by looking at those samples, we can then use that to understand which systems that they've been on, where they've taken the data from, and that helps to inform the risk picture, which helps the client to make some more informed decisions. So for those reasons, it's sometimes worthwhile just beginning a negotiation process. Some companies think that by beginning that process, you might be raising the risk to yourselves because you're talking to the criminals. That is actually a very low risk in reality, because the way that ransomware organized crime groups are arranged is that the people that you're talking to in the negotiation are not the same people that actually attacked your network. There's a complex hierarchy of different actors who sell on information, and they perform different roles in the attack. And so so the risk to an organization through beginning a negotiation, as I say, even if you've got no intention of paying, is actually very, very low.
And do you know, one of the things that I think someone listening to this might be interested to understand then is, are you guys offering this service to everyone? Is it, big corporates? Is it a small business? Is it me as a consumer? Like, who is actually coming out and saying, CyberCare/Storm Guidance, please, you know, I'm getting on the line and talking to you guys when something happens?
We provide, we've got a CyberCare enterprise service that we provide to medium and large corporates. And that's similar to our ReSecure service that we offer through cyber insurance. The CyberCare standard service is really for smaller businesses, not for consumers, just for smaller businesses. And that essentially is a low-cost subscription, a monthly subscription of 250 Rand, and then a one-time payment of 6,500 Rand when an incident occurs. And we've confirmed that it's an incident. So that's essentially a service, as you were saying earlier, for the small businesses in South Africa that essentially don't really have anyone else to turn to if they need help. What we tend to find is that some organizations, especially small businesses, think that essentially law enforcement might be able to help them. Unfortunately, although law enforcement would love to do that, the scale of the number of incidents that are occurring, and the extra services that businesses need in order to investigate and recover are kind of, you know, would very, very quickly exhaust law enforcement, not only in South Africa, but any country. And then on the other side, you've got a lot of IT service providers that have got no real experience in digital investigations. And so asking them to assist, even though if they might well say yes, can then put you at risk, because they will do things such as, you know, inadvertently deleting very important evidence and things like that. So it's very important to have the right level of skills and experience on your side. And that's really what CyberCare is all about.
I'm sure someone listening to this would also be curious, especially on the consumer side, if there's any plans to have some type of a consumer offering. But on the side of small businesses that you guys do service, you know, what are usually the common types of attacks that small businesses, or I guess businesses in general, tend to face?
So the first part, we may well consider a consumer service in a year or so, once we've launched CyberCare in South Africa, and once we've really looked at the data. We don't want to just provide a sort of like an IT support desk. It must be really focused around supporting organisations and individuals if they're the victims of cybercrime. When it comes to sort of helping organizations in the understand the types of incidents that might occur, the most common incidents at the moment are ransomware, which I've already mentioned, and business email compromise, where organizations can have their mailboxes hijacked, essentially, or even individuals have this happen to them. And that's, you know, generally because the criminals want to see whether or not those organizations or individuals, they might be individual members of staff, whether or not they're involved in any transactions that they can get in the middle of, intercept, and then commit fraud. So that's really the main aim behind a business email compromise, for the attackers to commit fraud. And they'll do that by creating fake invoices, by creating fake domains, and then pretending to be one party or another, and deceiving the other side into making a payment.
That's actually quite alarming, and you know, hopefully businesses are looking out for some of these things. But as we end off, Neil, one of the things that you did mention earlier on is the introduction of POPI in South Africa. That is the Protection of Personal Information Act, and I'm sure that a lot of South Africans would have been receiving emails and SMSs about you know, the start of the act on the 1st of July, so that was last week. And talking to other cybersecurity experts, one of the things, one of the insights I recently got was the fact that countries like South Africa and, you know, neighboring countries, etc., are increasingly becoming attractive because they previously didn't have strong enough regulation or enough teeth when it comes to, you know, prosecuting cyber criminals, etc. And around the world, it seems the gold standard is GDPR in Europe, against which POPI has been sort of modeled after, from my understanding. So the real question then, especially, you know, as POPI begins in South Africa, then is, from a GDPR point of view, what has given GDPR so much respect, credence around the world? Is it what's actually written in the law, or would you say it's more how the Europeans have gone about enforcing that law?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I would say that GDPR took many years to put together, and which I'm sure you won't be surprised, you know, the wheels take a long time to turn in Europe. But certainly it's a very well planned, a very well thought out and executed regulation. And obviously each individual country is part of the European Economic Area, part of the European Union, has to enact GDPR in their own local law. So that results in data protection acts in many different countries, and POPIA is South Africa's version of that, if you like, and being based or following many of the principles that are explained as really good ethics, a really good ethical way of protecting and processing personal information, means that it then makes South African business very attractive as a, if you like, as a safe place to do business. When it comes to processing personal information, and yeah, so that's when it comes to the security aspects. Well, the security principles in the POPI Act again are kind of, you know, very reflective of GDPR. And when organizations suffer data breaches, then POPIA also requires those who are suffering those breaches to report to the regulators, to the information regulator, those particular incidents. And then the regulator can then take a view, essentially, as to whether or not the organization was properly enacting the security requirements of the Act in the protection of personal information, or whether they were in some way failing in that regard. And then there may well then be some enforcement actions following on from that. The other thing that's very important, as required by POPIA, is notification to other parties that might be at risk as well. So it's not just the regulator, but it's also parties that may be, for instance, described in data that's been stolen by attackers, who then may be at risk of fraud or other cyber attack as well. So, you know, the Act requires that they be notified so that they're not at risk.
As we end off on a last point for this conversation, Neil, against the backdrop of everything that you've said, the enforcement part tends to be very important. And throughout this conversation, we've sort of drawn these parallels between, real world crimes versus, cyber crimes, in a sense. And when it comes to the incident that we used earlier on, if someone breaks into my house, you call the rapid response, etc. But usually the police is involved, somewhere along that chain. So when it comes to that piece, because you've had experience in a number of different countries, etc., what do you make of, I guess, law enforcement or police's stance or ability to deal with cyber crimes, right? Or would you say that cyber crimes have sort of become the domain of private sector players such as yourselves?
No, I think it's very important that law enforcement are made aware of cyber crimes as they occur. Of course, it's down to individual businesses and individuals that are the victims of any crime, not just cyber crime, to make those reports and to allow the police to understand the level of criminality, the number of incidents that are occurring. And generally, it's the job of law enforcement to spend the taxpayers' money in the most effective way possible. And that's usually in trying to take down the serious organized crime groups, because they can have the biggest effect in doing that. So individual incidents, whilst they may well be interesting to the police, it's generally not possible for them to be investigating each and every cyber crime. But it's certainly important that they know about that. So we would encourage organizations to report crimes to the police, not necessarily have an expectation that the police are going to be able to or be sufficiently resourced to help them in every aspect of that particular crime. I guess just like a burglary, right? The police would be there to say, okay, it looks like, we might have a look at some CCTV. We might be able to get a little bit of an idea who's behind this, but they won't be actually helping you rebuild your apartment and put everything right again. And it's similar with cybercrime, really. The other really challenging thing for South African and law enforcement around the world is that the criminals, and one of the reasons why cybercrime is so attractive to criminals, is because it is a truly international crime. And whereas South African law is really all about South Africa, that's the jurisdiction, and that's really what the police are asked to where the police are asked to protect their citizens. The police SAPs are very limited when it comes to bringing criminals who are operating halfway around the world to justice. And again, it's the same challenge for any law enforcement in any country. And not only do they not always have the powers to be able to do that, but also they need to have the budget and the money to be able to do it. And so if they're saying, we've got high levels of crime in these particular parts of the country or these particular parts of various cities, of physical crime, and we need to try and do something about that. But then we're being told actually that there's a few cyber crimes that are occurring. We need to spend half of our annual budget on trying to track down international cyber criminals. Then, it's going to be quite understandable as to where they're going to be wanting to deploy their resources and spend their money. It's going to be at home where they're going to make the biggest difference and be able to actually prosecute those crimes. So, that criminals know this, and that's why for them it's a very low risk occupation and why they operate internationally.
Perhaps as a quick follow-up, because I'm actually surprised we hadn't actually addressed this earlier on. If someone does find themselves in that situation where you have been attacked, you're a small business owner or whatever, and then you realize that you've had, either a ransomware attack that you highlighted earlier on or business email compromise, etc. Like, what should someone actually do in that particular situation? Do I just step away from the computer and just not touch it? Or, what's usually the recommended procedure?
It depends very much on the incident that's occurred. Certainly, if it's a mailbox compromise, it's very important to change passwords immediately, to implement what we call multi-factor authentication, which is like a one-time code that I would recommend that absolutely every one of your listeners immediately enables multi-factor authentication on their accounts, because it makes those accounts significantly more resilient to attack. So enabling two-factor or multi-factor authentication, absolutely critical for protecting your mailboxes. And I would say, I mean, just to let you know that I use multi-factor authentication on everything that I do, not just my email, not just my bank account, but everything else, everything that I do online where I've got an account. Any provider that does not provide me with multi-factor authentication on their service, I don't use that service. So, yeah, multi-factor authentication, very important. When it comes to ransomware, the best thing you can do is to keep your systems updated. Make sure that they are properly patched. If you have an incident, then switching systems off is not such a bad idea, although it will not in any way guarantee you a recovery. But making sure also that you've got good backups, and also that those data backups are disconnected from the network when they're not being made. So that, because a lot of ransomware now will search out, seek and find backups and encrypt the backups first. So what you need to do is to make sure that your backups are sufficiently isolated so that the ransomware can't get to destroy those. And as I say, make sure that you subscribe to CyberCare, and then we'll be there to help you when you have an incident.
All right. So you heard it right there. That was us with Neil Hare Brown. He is from Storm Guidance. He is the CEO of Storm Guidance. They are a cybersecurity firm, specializing in response. And he was just talking to us about what's actually going on in the landscape, because he's actually said at the beginning of the conversation that their business has sort of grown along the increase in cybercrime, around the world. And that is increasing because people are doing more and more online. He's highlighting the fact that when it comes to actual attacks, the two most common types of attacks that businesses are dealing with at the moment, it is the ransomware attacks and also the business email compromise attacks. And at the end there, he was giving us some guidelines just around what to actually do. If I remember correctly, if there's an email compromise, change your passwords immediately. He's advocating for not two-factor, but multi-factor authentication when it comes to, the platforms that you are dealing with, and also saying that it's always good to keep backups of your data that aren't necessarily connected to the internet, just as a way to protect yourself. Neil, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks very much for having me, Madewa. Have a good day.
This is Madewa's Take.
A very fascinating discussion with Neil, and fascinating because of how scary it really seems as if the world is becoming more and more as we do things online. And I think a lot of it is against the back of the increased level of transactions that are going on, online. Because back in the day, when it came to the internet was more a billboard. Companies would, just put up their website and tell you what they're doing, etc. But when people started being able to transact online, the rise of e-commerce, etc., now you're giving the hackers and cyber criminals different points, whether they intercept your credit card details, whether they intercept emails to your suppliers, all of these things that have come with the rise of doing more and more business online. So from that point of view, it's quite scary, and people really do need to be able to protect themselves out there, and especially businesses and small businesses. We often hear that in South Africa, small businesses are a big engine for the country, its growth, employment, and all of these things. And the other way to think about it is the fact that because of the importance of small businesses, their vulnerability, becomes even more magnified, because if you are able to attack a number of small businesses, then you are affecting the livelihoods of lots of people. And, you know, you affect the livelihoods. You might even affect or infect a number of people that work for a particular organization. So it's very important that people should be out there protecting themselves and how they do business online. I guess the other piece that's coupled with that, you know, it's good to see something like CyberCare coming online, a hotline, a rapid response of some sort that you can have. As you know, as people get attacked, there should be someone that you can call. And I'd really do hope that in future that they do find a way to implement some type of a consumer product, because I really do think that would be, you know, something that individuals would really benefit from, because, you know, a lot of people are, you know, falling victim to all of these nefarious characters online. And perhaps, you know, that might be a good way to just protect the entire chain, protect the consumers, the small businesses, the large corporates, and hopefully making it harder on the whole for cyber criminals to infiltrate. And that's been it for this edition of the Business Day Spotlight. Remember that you can find our latest podcast on Business Live. That's under the podcast Business Day Spotlight tab on Twitter with hashtag BD Spotlight. And remember that you can review and subscribe for free on iono.fm, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, or wherever you choose to get your pods casted. Thank you to our amazing team. Our producer is Paige Muller. I've been Mudiwa Gavaza of the Business Day and Financial Mail. And this has been another edition of the Business Day Spotlight, which is a multimedia live production. So for myself and the rest of the team, it is good evening, good afternoon, and good morning.